You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
So let's talk a little Los Angeles Dodgers baseball. As if you've been listening to these podcasts, you know that I've been a little bit skeptical of their rotation, but maybe it's a little bit better than I thought. I'm Allison Footer, and I'm here with one of our veteran columnists and reporters, Barry Bloom, who has been all over the country watching everybody and has watched a lot of Dodgers baseball in his life. So, Barry, I want to talk about the rotation a little bit. Scott Kazmir, you know, mixed reviews, but Kenta Maeda has been, like, completely on fire. Are you a little surprised about how well he's done so early?
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, Al, I saw him a lot in spring training. He's an interesting pitcher because he's not one of these typical Japanese power pitchers that have been coming over lately. He's a guy who comes down three quarters from the side and throws, and he mixes up a couple of breaking pitches. His fastball's maybe 91, 92 miles an hour. He's more like Tanaka was when he came up a couple of years ago before the arm problems, being able to run balls around the plate. And you'll see over the course of time whether the league catches up with him and whether he adjusts because, you know, one of the things with Tanaka is that, aside from the injuries, he just never really adjusted when his fastball velocity went down. The knock on Maeda, obviously, is he's had elbows problems, and that's why the Dodgers signed him to a make-good contract. Really, he can make $100 million over the course of 8 years, but the base is about 25, which is unusual for a Japanese pitcher coming over. But really, he has the tools, and he's just really fun to watch.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, what do you think, who has the advantage? Because when we see, like, a young hitter come out, like we're seeing with Story in Colorado, and just like a kid that comes out and there's, like, not a lot of video on him, there's not a lot of scouting on him, and then the league adjusts to him, and then he, you know, has to adjust back. And, of course, his numbers come down to something more normal. But when it comes to a pitcher coming out and having so much success like that, it's not quite as easy for a hitter to adjust to a pitcher, is it, than for pitchers to adjust to hitters, if that makes any sense?
Well, I think when you come to Maeda and Story, it's kind of like apples and oranges because, you know, Story's kind of a minor leaguer who emerged out of nowhere and had a great March and carried it over into April. But Maeda's a kid who's been – really not such a kid, but he's been scouted up the yin-yang by every American scout who has anything to do with international, and they know him inside out, just like this kid Otani over there who's the next best thing. They're scouting him inside out. Everybody knows what he's going to do, and if a guy is posted, he goes to, at this point, he goes to a general physician for one of the teams and gets a workup, and it's given to every one of the teams. So everybody knows really what this guy is able to do. So answering that, is it tougher for a hitter or a pitcher? I think it's always tougher for a hitter because the failure rate for hitters is so great as opposed to pitchers. I mean, if you're a pitcher, you're gonna hit on well over 50%, probably 70 to 90% success. And if you're a hitter, look, Tony Gwynn, one of the great hitters of our time, had a 34% success rate out of 100. So that tells you how tough it is for hitters.
That's very true. Yeah, no, I just, I've seen, you know, you see pitchers that come out of the gate, like, just on fire. Everything does even out. Of course, the law of averages, it's the main law of baseball. But at the same time, like, this guy's just been amazing. So, good for him. Overall, the rotation, I mean, I guess there's like a couple guys like Ross Stripling has come through and he's had a couple good starts, so they've really been able to solidify things there. What do you think of the entire sort of just rotation as it stands right now?
$36 million are on the disabled list for them right now. They don't know when Ryu is going to be back. He's just come up with a groin strain on top of rehabbing from the shoulder surgery a year ago. McCarthy's out, you know, rehabbing from TJ surgery last year. He's not coming back till July at the earliest. Anderson is out for the season, and they're paying him. So they've had to really stopgap. I mean, you didn't want Kazmir as their number two starter. I mean, if Kazmir is their number four starter and Maeda is their number three, they're probably in pretty good shape. But this is just a patchwork. And, you know, I feel sorry for Davey Roberts that this is his first shot at managing and this is what he winds up with. But, you know, the guys at the top there are just trying to fill the gaps at this point. I don't think they would want to go out and spend any more money to do it. They could have gotten Cole Hamels last year and they didn't pull it off. So, I mean, it is where it is. And, you know, the guy that you mentioned, the rookie, I saw him the last week of spring training and the Padres just lit him up. But they brought him out of minor league camp and then 5 days later he was in the rotation. It reminds me of Heston last year for the Giants coming out of nowhere and pitching well the first half of the season. But I don't think he's going to do well over the long term. He's a stopgap pitcher. So I think you look at that, and their rotation is very problematic over the course of time until some of these guys come back if they do.
I want to talk about Matt Cain, who has had three starts. Not great starts, we have to say. His first one looked pretty good. Most recently, he had four shutout innings, and then he couldn't finish the fifth against the Diamondbacks. He says it wasn't fatigue, but I guess this is something that they're just going to have to keep their eye on to figure out what they have in him, right?
Yes. Yes, Allison. They really don't have anybody else. I mean, it's too early in the minor league season to judge who they would call up. If, you know, here I am talking about possible replacements. I guess Clayton Blacker would be one, but it's befuddling them. They don't know. They don't quite know right now. Matt Cain doesn't quite know right now what is ailing him, so to speak. Whether it's something literally ailing him or just, you know, mechanical problems or the like, but. It's just not working out. He gets to the fifth inning, and, you know, presto, he gives up a bunch of hits, and he's gone.
Yeah, I mean, he says it wasn't fatigue, and, I mean, I understand that it's not like he's going to, you know, give a minute-by-minute analysis of what he thinks is going on. He doesn't want to overthink it, and he's certainly not going to share all of his feelings with reporters. But at the same time, given, like, all of the time that he hasn't been pitching – in recent times, and what he's been through, it would be almost understandable, right, if he didn't quite have the stamina that he needs?
Yeah, although, you know what, he's had plenty of, you know, in one respect, it would be understandable. In another respect, I mean, he's had plenty of time to work his way back, but they've given him a lot of opportunity, because they're giving him a lot of money, I'd say.
Right.
And he feels that pressure. I mean, he's a former staff ace. People forget about that, I think, sometimes. So, it's a tough problem they've got.
Yeah, you got to feel for a guy who was throwing perfect games not that long ago. I mean, we can't forget like how nailed he was as a healthy pitcher. And like you said, he's getting paid. Is there any, I mean, if this would continue, would they move him to a bullpen role where he can fire it out for a couple innings and be done? I mean, I know it would be hard to, what, he's making like 15 a year? I mean, I guess that would be really hard to do, but would that even be a possibility?
Yes, there's a possibility. They did it with Tim Lincecum. You know, there was no greater pitching hero than him here, you know, while he – during his tenure in San Francisco. Maybe we can get to the on a separate note, that's kind of ironic. They need pitching help, and who knows what Tim Lincecum's doing right now. But anyway.
Yeah.
And they did that they did that with Matt early on in his career. He had a little slump. And they put him in a bullpen. He had a very strong, I distinctly remember, a two-inning outing at Houston, which was particularly strong, and then he went out through a one-hitter in his next outing, which was a start, a one-hit complete game. I don't know if that sort of thing is within the realm right now, but certainly putting him in a bullpen and letting him work it out for a while is a possibility.
Okay, so let's move on to Chris Heston. So now we have a guy who was sent out to AAA basically so he could get regular work in. So he's working as a long reliever, and as we know, long relief comes and goes. It's there, and then you may not get anything for a while. Certainly a guy who could be a starter. I mean, he has shown that he obviously can handle that job. So he's basically going to go the rotation just to get regular work in. I would not be shocked if he was back in the rotation, not the bullpen, but the rotation, sooner than later, right?
That's just that, Allison. That's just it. I think they're we want him to be have a chance to at least push for being the number five starter. You know, it's a little early to be thinking trade or anything like that right now. But yeah, I mean, they've got while they have this guy who proved last year he could be a viable starter. You know, he's still around, and so why not get him ready to start?
AJ, we have to talk Balk, because there was an interesting Balk during the Pirates-Padres game recently, and Andy Green got thrown out, and I have to say that I agree with why he was so bad. So let's first talk about what led up to the umpires doing what they did on the actual Balk.
Yeah, so I'm not sure you'll ever get Andy Green to say that it was the right call, but in my opinion, at least, I thought it was the right call ultimately that they called a balk, because you could see his back foot come off the ground entirely. That's kind of irrelevant in this whole situation. I mean, I think it's more about the fact that they initially called it a balk. They all got together and decided, hey, you know what? With what we saw with these four minds put together, we don't think it was a balk based on whatever evidence they had. And then Clint Hurdle comes out, and essentially the first time he comes out, he's allowed to get an explanation. Well, he gets his explanation, he comes out and argues again. Ultimately, they get together again and change their minds again, which I've never seen a call overturned two separate times, one time after the manager comes out and argues it. And so I don't think Andy Green was so much upset with the call, because, like I said, it may have been the right call. I mean, we all know the balk rule. There's so many stipulations that go into it, so it may or may not have been. It's just kind of the way it all went down. And you know what? It kind of – he said he wasn't doing it to light a fire under the Padres, but I think it had that effect.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the reasons – well, one of the main rules about a balk is that you're not allowed to argue it, right? I mean, isn't that an immediate ejection if you come out to argue that? And I think that was where Andy just lost his mind, that Clint Hurdle wasn't being penalized for this, correct?
Yeah, and so it's understandable. If you watch the whole sequence again, and the sequence lasted forever, it seems like,
right.
Clint Hurdle's more than entitled to come out and get an explanation for why the umpires changed their mind, what ultimately led to their decision to change their mind. I mean, as the manager of the club, you'd expect that. But he goes back toward the dugout, then comes back out, and at that point he's already been given his explanation. So through my understanding of the rules and through Andy Green's understanding of the rules, you're not allowed to argue a balk. He should have been ejected right there. And after that, Andy Green went and got his money for it.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty epic. I was pretty proud of Andy. I don't really know him very well. I only met him once, but it was
He is one of the more even-keel, low-key guys you'll ever see. In fact, there's a video of him when he was a minor league manager kind of doing the same thing he did last night. And none of the players have ever said they've ever seen anything like that. So now they have, and you know what? It might have worked out for the better for the Padres.
Yeah, no doubt. We might see some photography of like some still photos of his outrage, maybe pinned up on the walls in the clubhouse sometime. it was pretty epic. But so Adam Rosales, and this is, I love this for a couple of different reasons. Number one, in spring training when I was at Padres camp, and I was only there for one day, but Andy Green tells a story about when he was it's toward the end of his minor league career, and I can't remember the team that he had signed with. I think it was the Reds. He would be in AAA with them, and Rosales was a minor leaguer, and he told, I guess the clubhouse guys kind of decide, arrange like who your roommates are. And so Green tells whoever was working for the team, put me with the cleanest living guy. That's who I want a room with. And they put him with Adam Rosales. So the two of them were actually minor league roommates. So I love that. I asked Adam about it later, and he was just like kind of very like awestruck, but you know, he didn't seem to really want to talk about it. But he was very he was very flattered that somebody said that he was actually a guy that lives his life pretty well. So that being said, so Adam Rosales he hits a home run, and the reason why this is so great is because we can now track how fast he runs around the bases and where this falls into other trots around the bases on a home run. And it needs to be said that he is the second fastest home run trot in the StatCast era. So what, this one obviously wasn't like trying to show anybody up. I mean, Adam Rosales is this like really kind, gentle soul. So why does he run so fast?
That's just the way he's always played, and it's interesting because he's like, he finished second on the Statcast leaderboard. If he hits, I don't know how many home runs he's going to end the season with, but say he ends the season with 6 or 7 home runs, all 6 or 7 of them are going to end up in the top 25 on the Statcast leaderboard. He sprints down to first base on walks. I know that's something that can be tracked. I don't know if we do track it, but from home to first on walks, I guarantee you he's the fastest average time. So that's just kind of the way he plays the game. It's kind of refreshing. And he's like you said, he's not showing anyone up. He's sprinting around the bases, and he's getting back in the dugout as fast as he can and high-fiving his teammates. It's kind of cool to see.
Thomas, the Rockies are in first place. Let's enjoy this while we can. Let's bask in the glory that are the Colorado Rockies. I'm going to talk about Trevor Story, but I'm not going to start with him because I know that you have to talk about him all the time. So we'll move on to Jordan Lyles, who had a very nice start against the Cincinnati Reds recently, which is something that needs to happen more often. I know that he struggled in his first couple of outings, but they need Jordan Lyles to step up and be a big part of this rotation if this thing is going to work this year, and he certainly showed good signs of it in his last outing.
Yes, he did. I mean, and it's the type of stuff that you expect from Jordan Lyles, for him to attack with his fastball, for him to challenge tough left-handed hitters inside, then use all his secondary stuff. He has a lot of pitches, and a lot of them can be good if he throws his fastball. And he did so against the Reds on Monday night and ended up pitching 7 innings. Could have thrown a complete game, to be honest with you, but the game was tied in the 7th, and that's kind of the way it goes in the National League. You're in an offensive park. You need runs. He was leading off. He would have been leading off the 8th inning. They pulled him out of there. Then ended up getting home runs from Trevor Story and from Ben Paulson and opening up a lead. But if they get that type of start from Lyles, that is huge for them. One time through the order, with Lyles' outing being the final one, they posted a 1.42 ERA. It was not the Rockies' terrible rotation that we were expecting. Instead, it was the best of what they can do. And, you know, can they keep this up over the long haul? We'll see. You know, right now you're sitting here in April, and the Rockies are doing well, and it happens every year. Going into this year, the last 3 years, they had the third best record in the National League in April. It's after April that's been an issue, but if they have the depth that they think that they have, maybe this can sustain itself a little bit longer.
Yeah, Jordan Lyles, how old is he these days? Do you remember offhand how old he is?
He's 25, I believe it is, and I'll have it. But, I mean, when he came up with the Astros at age 20, it seems like he's been there forever. I mean, you would expect to see gray hair, but you don't, because he's only 25. That's right, 25 years old.
Wow, yeah. That should be noted, because, and obviously there are the extra challenges of pitching in Colorado, but there's sometimes when, and I don't want to get, like, too ahead of ourselves with just one start, but I was just talking to Alvin Gonzalez, who covers the Angels, and he was talking about Hector Santiago, and he seems to have a couple miles an hour more on his fastball. He had this dominant outing. They've been, like, waiting a really long time for him to put a full, like, dominant season together. And sometimes things just happen for a pitcher randomly, where things click, and then they sort of become, you know, they're off and running. And we have to give Jordan Lyles a pretty long leash given his young age, right?
That's correct. And if you look through this rotation, it's all over the Rockies' rotation. Like Tyler Chatwood, who pitched very well in Chicago against the Cubs, Alden covered him with the Angels. It seems like he's been around forever. He's only 26 years old. And we've been talking about John Gray since the day he was drafted, but the fact of the matter is, and he should start get back into the rotation very soon. The fact of the matter is, he's only 24, and he was only drafted in 2013. It just seems like forever because we've talked about him all the time. I mean, that's the type of rotation that they have here. They have some youth behind it. Now, when does that youth grow up? Or, you know, do very many young pitchers come in and pitch well immediately, or is there a bit of a growing pain? It seems like you'll see some growing pains with some Rockies pitchers, but once they get it, maybe they can have a rotation like the Aaron Cooks and the Jeff Francis's of a few years back.
Let's talk a little about Nolan Arenado. I can't talk enough about this guy, but he's really he had that ridiculously phenomenal spring and then kind of went a little radio silent for the first couple of days of the regular season. But he is on fire, hitting the way we know he can hit, and the defense has been amazing. I mean, you cannot say enough about what he's doing, and obviously we can't because we talk about him every week. But really, I mean, we have to. He has to be. I mean, if he continues this, then we're talking about a legitimate like MVP candidate by the All-Star break. It would probably be him and maybe three other people.
Yes, and I think we talked about it before the season how possible it was for him to actually win the MVP award. Now, the team will have to go a long way for him to do it, but what I want to know is what is he not doing? You know, he is producing runs. He's hitting home runs. He is absolutely dominant on defense. He has a big smile and does things on television and is fan-friendly. There's nothing about him that isn't good. The only thing is people don't know about him because the Rockies haven't won. But if that part gets taken care of, this guy is he should be one of the faces of Major League Baseball. I mean, he's that type of individual, and he's that type of player.
Steve, the D-backs had a little bit of a rocky start, but things seem to even out. And Robbie Ray, let's talk about his recent start versus the Giants, a very good one, and improvements in a lot of areas. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Allison, you know, Robbie's always had great stuff, and his numbers last year, if you look at his ERA, was very good. But they really wanted him to improve his pitch efficiency, to not, you know, have so many deep counts so that he couldn't, pitch deep into games. And so last night, as we're recording this on Wednesday, he was able to go six innings. They needed those innings because the bullpen's been a bit overtaxed. And he was able to do that because he only walked two guys. He was a little bit more efficient, and he was using all his pitches, his breaking ball, his changeup, his fastball. And when he throws like that, that's the kind of guy that really excites the Diamondbacks, and it's the kind of guy that they are waiting to see break out on an absolute regular basis.
Yeah, is there a reason why the Diamondbacks play so well in San Francisco? That's a really weird place for an opposing team to do well. I mean, that's a hard place for teams to win when you're not the Giants. The vibe, the atmosphere, the sold-out crowds, the fact that the Giants play very well there. Diamondbacks have won 8 of their last 9 games there and 10 of 12. Is there a reason for this?
You know, it seems kind of crazy to me because for as long as I can remember, they didn't play well at AT&T Park, and they would seem to find ways to lose when they played there. And all of a sudden now they can't seem to lose there. So you ask them why that is, and sometimes people just try to come up with explanations for you. They really don't have a good explanation for you. But the going theory right now, at least talking with Chris Owings and Chip Hale, is that the atmosphere that you refer to, which is always very good, very passionate fan base that they have there right now, is actually working in the Diamondbacks' favor because it helps them to get energized for a game. And playing in front of a crowd like that and at a ballpark like that, and that they really enjoy kind of playing there. And it's also a pretty pitcher-friendly park, so it seems to make their pitchers relax a little bit. So that seems to be the theory. I really don't know that there is an explanation for it, but it is quite a turn from where it was just a couple of years ago.
Does that surprise you at all? I'm always a little – I guess I just think of like when you're an opposing player on the road, that the hostile crowd would work kind of negatively against you. I mean, not that they really think about it too much either way, but it's amazing to me that a player could be fueled by what are hostile taunts and things against them, when I guess it's just any loud noise is going to get them fired up.
Well, and I think it's just the energy that's in that ballpark too could be part of it. You know, over a course of a long season and a lot of games played, maybe necessarily not in front of a packed house or in front of a quieter crowd as they go around. When they come to a place like AT&T that's kind of electric like that, maybe that does give a little jolt of electricity, but gives them a little bit of jolt of energy as they, to kind of break up the monotony.
Yeah, everybody's all hyped up on those crazy crab sandwiches. So let's move to, I love that place. Oh, I could eat. If I ate dinner there every night, I'd weigh 800 pounds, but I would be the happiest person on the planet.
Are you a garlic fries person?
Garlic fries, the cha-cha bowl. I mean, I would be dead broke, too, by the way. But, oh, my gosh, do I love that food. And the clam chowder and the sourdough bread bowl. Woo! Anyway, so let's move on to the fact that the bullpen, we're 14, 15 games in the season, the bullpen is already overworked. They're already making roster moves. They've already had two extra inning games. Oh, my goodness. So it's really the bullpen that gets the brunt of all of this when they have to have these long games. So without, I'm not going to ask you to recite everything they've done lately, but there have been a lot of moves up and down to fortify that bullpen.
Yeah, you know, I'll say that the biggest thing that hurt them was Saturday night, Shelby Miller did something that most of the staff has never seen before in their careers in baseball. He hit his right hand on the pitcher's mound during his follow-through twice during one batter and ended up having his hand throb and had to leave the game, and his hand was all cut up and bleeding. And so that they left. He had left in the second inning of what turned out to be a 14-inning game, and that right there just really set the bullpen back. It was already kind of on fumes, and that was the thing that really kind of pushed it over the edge. So they've made a bunch of different roster moves, trying to get fresh arms up from Reno, and it seems like over the last 24, 48 hours, things have stabilized somewhat now to where they might not need to make any moves, at least not for the next few days.